Side 8. The cab smelled of old cigar smoke, and Bond pressed down the switch of the power-operated window. A furnace blast of air made him close it again. The driver half-turned in his seat.
"Don't want to do that, Mr. Bond," he said in a friendly voice. "Cab's conditioned. May not seem so, but it's better than outside."
"Thanks," said Bond, and then, "I believe you're a friend of Felix Leiter."
"Sure," said the driver, over his shoulder. "Nice guy. Tell me to watch out for you. Be glad if I can do anything while you're here. Staying long?"
"I can't say," said Bond. "A few days, anyway."
"Tell you what," said the driver. "Don't think I'm trying to jip you, but we're going to do some work together, and you got some dough. Maybe you'd better hire the cab by the day. $50, but I got to make a living. It'll make sense to the front boys of the hotels and so on. Don't see otherwise how I'm to keep close. Like that, they'll understand me hanging about waiting for you half the day. There are a suspicious lot of bastards on the strip."
It couldn't be better. Bond had at once liked and trusted the man. "It's a deal."
"Okay." The driver expanded a little. "You see, Mr. Bond, folks around here don't like anything out of the ordinary. What I say, they're suspicious. I mean, you'll look like anything except a tourist who's come to lose his wad, and they get a bad case of nose trouble. Take yourself. Anyone can see you're a limey even before you start talking. Clothes and so forth. Well, what's a limey doing here? And what sort of limey is this? He looks kind of a tough guy. So let's just take a good look at him."
He half turned. "Did you see a fella hanging around the terminal with a leather shaving kit under his arm?" Bond remembered the man who had watched him at the oxygen bar.
"Yes, I did," he said,
and it was then he realized that the oxygen had made him careless.
"Bet your life he's looking at your pictures right now," said the driver.
16mm camera in that shaving kit. Just pull down the zip and press your arm against it, and off it goes. He'll take him 50 feet, straight and profile, and that'll be with mug identification at headquarters this afternoon, with a list of what you got in your bag.
You don't look as if you're carrying a gun. Maybe it's a flat holster job. But if you are, there'll be another man with a gun alongside all the time you're in the rooms. Word'll be sent down the line by this evening. Better watch out for any fellow with a coat on. Nobody wears them here save to house the artillery."
"Well, thanks," said Bond, annoyed with himself. "I can see I'll have to keep a bit wider awake. Pretty good machine they seem to have here." The driver grunted affirmatively and drove on in silence. They were just entering the famous Strip, the desert on both sides of the road, which had been empty except for occasional hoardings advertising the hotels, was beginning to sprout gas stations and motels. They passed a motel with a swimming pool, which had built up transparent glass sides. As they drove by, a girl dived into the bright green water, and her body sliced through the tank in a cloud of bubbles. Then came a gas station with an elegant drive-in restaurant.
"Gasseteria," it said. "Fresh up here. Hot dogs, jumbo burgers, atom burgers, ice-cool drinks, drive-in."
And there were two or three cars being served by waitresses in high-heeled shoes and two-piece bathing suits. The great six-lane highway stretched on through a forest of multicolored signs and frontages until it lost itself downtown in a dancing lake of heat waves. The day was hot and sultry as a fire opal. The swollen sun burned straight down the middle of the frying concrete, and there was no shade anywhere except under the few scattered palms in the forecourts of the motels. A glittering gunfire of light splinters shot at Bond's eyes from the windscreens of oncoming cars and from the blaze of chrome styling, and he felt his wet shirt clinging to his skin.
"Coming into the Strip now," said the driver. "Otherwise known as Rue de la Paix, spelt P-A-Y. Joke, see?"
"Got it," said Bond.
"On your right, the Flamingo,"
said Ernie Cureau, as they passed a low-lying modernistic hotel with a huge tower of neon, now dead, outside it.
"Bugsy Siegel built that back in 1946. He came over to Vegas from the coast one day and took a look around. Had a lot of hot money looking for investment. Vegas was going great guns, town wide open, gambling, legalized cat shops, nice setup. It didn't take long for Bugsy to catch on. He saw the possibilities."
Bond laughed at the pregnant phrase.
"Yes, sir," continued the driver. "Bugsy saw the possibilities and moved right in. Stayed with it until 1947 when they blew some of his head off with so many bullets the cops never got around to finding them all. Then there's the Sands. Plenty of hot money behind that one. Don't rightly know whose. Built a couple of years ago. Front guy's a nice fella, name of Jack Entrada. Used to be at the Copa in New York. Maybe you heard of him."
"Afraid not," said Bond. Well, then, here's the Desert Inn, Wilbur Clark's place. But the money came from the old Cleveland-Cincinnati combination. And that dump with the Flatiron sign is the Sahara. Latest thing. Listed owners are a bunch of small-time gamblers from Oregon. Funny thing, they lost $50,000 on their opening night. Would you believe it? All the big shots come along with their pockets full of dough to make some courtesy play. Make the first night a success, you understand. It's a custom here for the rival outfits to gather around at an opening. But boy, the cards just wouldn't cooperate, and the opposition guys walked off with $50,000. Town's laughing about it still. Then, he waved to the left, where the neon was wrought into a 20-foot covered wagon at full gallop, you get the last frontier. That's a dummy western town on the left. Worth seeing. And over there's the Thunderbird, and across the road's the Tiara. Snazziest joint in Vegas. Guess you know about Mr. Spang and all that? He slowed down and halted opposite the Spang Hotel, which was topped by a ducal coronet of brilliant lights that winked on and off in a lost battle with the glaring sun and the reflections from the highway. Yes, I know the outlines, said Bond, but I'd be glad for you to fill them in sometime. And now what? Whatever you say, mister. Bond suddenly felt he'd had enough of the ghastly glitter of the strip. He only wanted to get indoors and out of the heat, have some lunch and perhaps a swim, and take things easy until the night. He said so. Suits me, said Correa. Guess you shouldn't get into much trouble your first night. Take it easy, though, and act kind of natural. If you got work to do in Vegas, you better wait till you know your way around. And watch the gambling, friend, he chuckled. You ever hear of those silence towers they have in India? They say it takes those vultures only 20 minutes to strip a guy at the bones. Guess they take a bit longer at the Tiara. Maybe the union slow 'em down. The driver banged the gear lever into first. All the same, he said, watching the traffic in his driving mirror, there was one guy left Vegas with $100,000. He paused, waiting for a chance to cross the parkway. Only thing, he had $500,000 when he started to play. The car swung across the traffic, and under the pillared portico in front of the wide glass doors of the sprawling pink stucco building, the bell captain, in a sky-blue uniform, opened the cab door and reached in for Bond's bag. Bond stepped out into the heat. As he shouldered his way through the glass doors, he heard Ernie Cureo say to the captain, "Some crazy limey hired me for $50 a day. What do you know about that?" And then the door swung to behind him, and the beautiful cold air welcomed him with a chill kiss into the glittering palace of the man called Serafimo Spang. Chapter 16. The Tiara. Bond had lunch in the air-conditioned sunburst room beside the big kidney-shaped swimming pool. Lifesaver Bobby Bilbo, pool scarred daily by hydrojet, said a sign, and having decided that only about 1% of the customers were fit to wear bathing suits, walked very slowly through the heat across the 20 yards of baked lawn that separated his building from the central establishment, took off his clothes, and threw himself naked on his bed. There were 6 buildings containing the bedrooms of the Tiara, and they were named after jewels. Bond was on the ground floor of the Turquoise. Its motif was eggshell blue, with furnishing materials of dark blue and white. His room was extremely comfortable and equipped with expensive and well-designed modern furniture of a silvery wood that might have been birch. There was a radio beside his bed and a television set with a 17-inch screen beside the broad window. Outside the window there was a small enclosed breakfast patio. It was very quiet, and there was no sound from the thermostat-controlled air conditioning, and Bond was almost instantly asleep. He slept for 4 hours, and during this time, the wire recorder, concealed in the base of the bedside table, wasted several 100 feet of wire on dead silence. When he awoke, it was 7. The wire recorder noted that he picked up the telephone and asked for Miss Tiffany Case, and after a pause said, "Would you please tell her that Mr. James Bond called?" and put back the receiver. It then picked up the noise of Bond moving about the room, the hiss of the shower, and, at 7:30, the click of his key in the lock as he went out and shut the door. 30 minutes later, the recorder heard a knock on his door, and then, after a pause, the noise of the door opening. A man, dressed like a waiter, with a basket of fruit bearing a note saying, "With the compliments of the management, came into the room, and walked quickly over to the bedside table. He undid two screws, removed the reel of fine wire on the recorder's turntable, replaced it with a fresh reel, put the basket of fruit on the dressing table, and went out and closed the door. And then, for several hours, the recorder whirred silently on, recording nothing. Bond sat at the long bar of the Tiara and sipped a vodka martini and examined the great gambling room with a professional eye. The first thing he noticed was that Las Vegas seemed to have invented a new school of functional architecture, the Gilded Mousetrap School, he thought it might be called, whose main purpose was to channel the customer mouse into the central gambling trap, whether he wanted the cheese or not. There were only two entrances, one from the street outside and one from the bedroom buildings and the swimming pool. Once you had come in through either of these, whether you wanted to buy a paper or cigarettes at the newsstand, have a drink or a meal in one of the two restaurants, get your hair cut or have a massage in the health club, or just visit the lavatories, there was no way of reaching your objective without passing between the banks of slot machines and gambling tables. And when you are trapped in the vortex of the whirring machines, amongst which there sounded always from somewhere the intoxicating silvery cascade of coins into a metal cup, or occasionally the golden cry of jackpot from one of the change girls, you are lost, besieged by the excited back-chat from the three big crap tables, the seductive whirl of the two roulette wheels, and the clank of silver dollars across the green pools of the blackjack tables. It would be a mouse of steel who could get through without tentative nibble at this delicious chunk of lucky cheese. But, reflected Bond, it could only be a trap for peculiarly insensitive mice, mice who would be tempted by the coarsest cheese. It was an inelegant trap, obvious and vulgar, and the noise of the machines had a horrible mechanical ugliness which beat at the brain. It was like the steady clanking of the engines of some old iron freighter on its way to the knacker's yard, unoiled, uncared for, condemned. And the gamblers stood and tore at the handles of the machines as if they hated what they were doing. And once they had seen their fate in the small glass window, they didn't wait for the wheels to stop spinning, but rammed in another coin and reached up a right arm that knew exactly where to go. Crank, clatter, ting, crank, clatter, ting. And then there was the occasional silvery waterfall. The metal cup would overflow with coins, and the gambler would have to go down on her knees to scrabble about under the machines for a rolling coin. For, as Leiter had said, they were mostly women, elderly women of the prosperous housewife class, and the droves of them stood at the banks of machines like hens in an egg battery, conditioned by the delicious coolness of the room and the music of the spinning wheels to go on laying it on the line until their wad was gone. Then, as Bond watched, a change girl's voice bawled, "Jackpot!" and some of the women raised their heads, and the picture changed. Now they reminded Bond of Dr. Pavlov's dogs, the saliva drooling down from their jaws at the treacherous bell that brought no dinner, and he shuddered at the thought of the empty eyes of these women, and their skins and their wet, half-open mouths and their bruised hands. Bond turned his back on the scene and sipped at his martini, listening with half his mind to the music from the famous name band at the end of the room next to the half-dozen shops. Over one of the shops, there was a pale blue neon sign which said, "The House of Diamonds." Bond beckoned to the barman. "Mr. Spang been around tonight?" "Ain't seen him," said the barman. "Mostly comes in after the first show, around 11. "You know him?" "Not personally." Bond paid his check and drifted over to the blackjack tables. He stopped at the center one. This would be his, at exactly 10:05. He glanced at his watch. 8:30. The table was a small, flat kidney of green baize. Eight players sat on high stools, facing the dealer, who stood with his stomach against the edge of the table and dealt two cards into the eight numbered spaces on the cloth in front of the stakes. The stakes were mostly 5 or 10 silver dollars, or counters worth 20. The dealer was a man of about 40. He had a pleasant half-smile on his face. He wore the dealer's uniform, white shirt buttoned at the wrists, a thin black western gambler's tie, a green eyeshade, black trousers. The front of the trousers was protected from rubbing against the table by a small green baize apron. Jake was embroidered in one corner. The dealer dealt and handled the stakes with unruffled smoothness. There was no talk at the table except when a player ordered a courtesy drink or cigarettes from one of the waitresses in black silk pyjamas who circulated in the central space inside the ring of tables. From this central space, the run of the play was watched over by two tough, lynx-eyed pit bosses with guns at their waists. The game was quick and efficient and dull. It was as dull and mechanical as the slot machines. Bond watched for a while and then moved away towards the doors marked smoking room and powder room on the far side of the casino. On his way, he passed four sheriffs in smart grey western uniforms. The legs of their trousers were tucked into half Wellingtons. These men were standing about unobtrusively, looking at nothing but seeing everything. At each hip they carried a gun in an open holster, and the polished brass of 50 cartridges shone at their belts. Plenty of protection around, thought Bond, as he pushed his way through the swing door of the smoking room. Inside, on the tiled wall, was a notice which said, "Stand up closer, it's shorter than you think." Western humor. Bond wondered if he dared include it in his next written report to M. He decided it would not appeal. He went out and walked back through the tables to the door beneath a neon sign which said, "The Opal Room." The low circular restaurant, pink and white and grey, was half full. The hostess swept over and piloted him to a corner table. She bent over to arrange the flowers in the middle of the table, and to show him that her fine bosom was at least half real, gave him a gracious smile and went away. After 10 minutes, a waitress with a tray appeared and put a roll on his plate and a square of butter. She also set down a dish containing olives and some celery, lined with orange cheese. Then a second and older waitress bustled over and gave him the menu and said, "Be right with you." 20 minutes after he'd sat down, Bond was able to order a dozen cherrystone clams and a steak, and, since he expected a further long pause, a second vodka dry martini. "The wine waiter will be right over," said the waitress primly, and disappeared in the direction of the kitchen. "Long on courtesy and short on service," reflected Bond, and resigned himself to the gracious ritual. During the excellent dinner that finally materialized, Bond wondered about the evening ahead and about how he could force the pace of his assignment. He was thoroughly bored with his role as a probationary crook who was about to be paid off for his first trial job and might then, if he found favor in the eyes of Mr. Spang, be given regular work with the rest of the teenage adults who made up the gang. It irked him not to have the initiative, to be ordered to Saratoga and then to this hideous sucker trap at the say-so of a handful of big-time hoodlums. Here he was, eating their dinner and sleeping in their bed while they watched him, James Bond, and weighed him up and debated with his hand was steady enough, his appearance trustworthy enough, and his health adequate to some sleazy job in one of their rackets. Bond munched his steak as if it was Mr. Serafimo Spang's fingers, and cursed the day he had taken on this idiotic role. But then he paused and went on eating more calmly. What the hell was he worrying about? This was a big assignment which so far had gone well. And now he had penetrated right to the end of the pipeline, right into the parlour of Mr. Serafimo Spang, who, with his brother in London and with the mysterious ABC, ran the biggest smuggling operation in the world. What did Bond's feelings matter? It was only a moment of self-disgust, a touch of nausea brought on by being a stranger who had spent too many days too close to these sordidly powerful American gangs, too close to the gunpowder-scented, gracious life of gangland aristocracy. The truth of the matter, Bond decided over coffee, was that he felt homesick for his real identity. He shrugged his shoulders. To hell with the Spangs and the hood-ridden town of Las Vegas. He looked at his watch. It was just 10 o'clock. He lit a cigarette and got to his feet, and walked slowly across the room and out into the casino. There were two ways of playing the rest of the game: by lying low and waiting for something to happen, or by forcing the pace so that something had to happen. Chapter 17. Thanks for the ride. The scene in the big gambling room had changed. It was much quieter. The orchestra had gone, and so had the droves of women, and there were only a few players at the tables. There were two or three shills at the roulette, attractive girls in smart evening dresses who had been given $50 with which to warm up the dead tables, and there was a very drunk man clinging on to the high surrounding wall of one of the crap tables and shouting exhortations to the dice. And something else had changed. The dealer at the centre blackjack table nearest the bar was Tiffany Case. So that was her job at the Tiara. And then Bond saw that all the blackjack dealers were pretty women, and that they were all dressed in the same smart Western outfit in grey and black, short grey skirt with a wide black metal-studded belt, grey blouse with a black handkerchief round the neck, a grey sombrero hanging down the back by a black cord, black half-wellingtons over flesh-coloured nylons. Bond looked at his watch again and moved slowly into the room. So Tiffany was going to false deal him to win $5,000. And, of course, they had chosen the moment when she had just come on duty, and the first show of the big-name review was still running in the Platinum Room. He would be alone with her at the table. No witnesses in case she muffed a deal from the bottom of the pack. At exactly 10:05, Bond strolled easily up to the table and sat down facing her. "Good evening." "Hi." She gave him a thin, correct smile. "What's the maximum?" "A grand." As Bond slapped the $10 notes down across the betting line, the pit boss strolled over and stood beside Tiffany Case. He barely glanced at Bond. "Maybe the guy would like a new deck, Miss Tiffany," he said. He handed her a fresh pack. The girl stripped the cover off it and handed him the used cards. The pit boss stood back a few paces and appeared to lose interest. The girl snapped the pack with a fluid motion of the hands, broke it and put the two halves flat on the table and executed what appeared to be a faultless scarn shuffle. But Bond saw that the two halves did not quite marry, and that when she lifted the pack off the table and carried out an innocent reshuffle, she would be getting the two halves of the pack back into their original order. She repeated the manoeuvre again and put the pack down in front of Bond in an invitation to cut. Bond cut the cards and watched with approval as she carried out the difficult single-handed annulment, one of the hardest gambits in card sharping. So the new deck was fixed, and the only result of all this fair play routine was to get all the cards back into the order in which they were arranged when they left the wrappers. But it was a brilliant manipulation, and Bond was full of admiration for the assurance of the girl's hands. He looked up into her grey eyes. Was there a hint of complicity in them, a hint of amusement at the odd game they were playing across the narrow green board? She dealt him two cards, and then gave two to herself. Suddenly Bond realized that he would have to be careful. He must play the exactly conventional game, or he might upset the whole sequence in which the cards had been prepared. Printed across the table were the words, "The dealer must draw on 16 and stand on 17. They would presumably have given him foolproof winning cards, but just in case there was another player, or a kibitzer, they would have to make his winning seem a natural run of luck, and not, for instance, just deal him 21 each time, and 17s to the girl. He glanced at his two cards, a knave and a 10. He looked up at the girl and shook his head. She turned up 16 and drew a card, busting herself with a king. She had a rack beside her which contained only silver dollars and counters for 20, but the pit boss was quickly at her side with a $1,000 pluck. She took it and tossed it over to Bond. He put it over the line and pocketed his notes. She flipped out two more cards to him and two to herself. Bond had 17, and again shook his head. She had 12 and drew a 3 and then a 9, 24, and bust again. Again, the pit boss stepped up with a pluck. Bond slipped it into his pocket and left his original stake. This time he had 19, and she turned up a 10 and 7, on which, by the rule, she had to stand. Another pluck went into Bond's pocket. The wide doors at the far end of the room had opened, and a stream of people were milling into the gambling room from the dinner review. Soon they would be around the tables. This was his last play. After this he must get up from the table and leave her. She was looking at him impatiently. He picked up the two cards that she had given him. 20. And she also turned up two tens. Bond smiled at the refinement. She quickly dealt him two more cards, just as three more players came up to the table and hitched themselves up on the stools. He had 19 and she had 16. And that was that. The pit boss didn't even bother to hand the girl the fourth plaque, but tossed it across the table to Bond, with an expression on his face that was very like a sneer.
"Jesus,"
said one of the new players as Bond pocketed the plaque and stood up. Bond looked across the table at the girl. "Thank you," he said. "You deal beautifully."
"I'll say,"
said the player who had spoken. Tiffany Case looked hard at Bond. "You're welcome," she said. She held his eyes for a fraction of a second, and then looked down at her cards, shuffled them thoroughly, and handed them to one of the new players for a cut. Bond turned his back on the table and moved off round the room, thinking of her, and occasionally glancing across at the straight, imperious little figure in the exciting Western uniform. Others obviously found her as attractive as Bond did, for soon there were 8 men sitting at her table, and others standing watching her. Bond felt a pang of jealousy. He walked over to the bar and ordered himself a bourbon and branch water to celebrate the $5,000 in his pocket. The barman produced a corked bottle of water and put it beside Bond's old granddad. "Where does this come from?" asked Bond, remembering what Felix Leiter had said. "Over by Boulder Dam," said the barman seriously. "Comes in by truck every day. Don't worry," he added. "It's the real stuff." Bond threw a silver dollar on the bar. "I'm sure it is," he said with equal seriousness. "Keep the change." He stood with his back to the bar and the glass in his hand, deciding his next move. So now he had been paid off, and Shady Tree had told him on no account to go back to the tables. Bond finished his drink and walked straight across the room to the nearest roulette table. There was only a sprinkling of gamblers at it, playing small. "What's the maximum here?" he said to the stick man, an elderly, balding individual with dead eyes who was just picking the ivory ball out of the wheel.
"$5,000, said the man indifferently.
Bond took the 4 plaques and the 10 $100 notes out of his pocket and put them beside the croupier. "On red." The croupier sat up straighter in his chair and squinted sideways at Bond. He tossed the 4 plaques, one by one, down onto the red, catching them there with his stick. He counted out Bond's notes, pushed them through a slot in the table, took a 5th plaque from the rack of counters beside him, and tossed this down to join the others. Bond saw his knee go up under the table. The pit boss heard the buzzer and strolled over to the table just as the croupier spun the wheel. Bond took out a cigarette and lit it. His hand was steady. He felt a wonderful sense of freedom at having at last taken the initiative from these people. He knew he was going to win. He hardly glanced at the wheel as it slowed down, and the little ivory ball rattled into its slot. 36, red, high and even. The stick man raked in a few losing counters and silver dollars and tossed some money down the table to the winners. Then he took a thin plaque as big as a prayer book out of his rack and put it softly down beside Bond. "Black," said Bond. The man threw a single plaque for $5,000 onto black and raked in Bond's stake from the red. There was a buzz of conversation around the table, and several more people drifted up and stood watching. Bond felt the curious eyes on him, but he only looked across the table into the eyes of the pit boss. They were as hostile as an adder's, and yet somehow scared. Bond smiled blandly at him as the wheel whirred, and there was the whiz of the little ball as it set off on its journey. 17, black, Lowenard, said the stick man. There was a sigh from the crowd, and hungry eyes watched the big plaque being slipped out of the rack and placed in front of Bond. Once more, thought Bond, but not this turn. "I'll stay away," he said to the croupier. The man glanced up at Bond and then reached out with his rake and pulled in Bond's stake and handed it to him. And then there was another man inside the pit, standing beside the pit boss, and he was looking at Bond with bright, hard eyes like camera lenses, and the fat cigar exactly in the center of his red lips was pointing straight at Bond like a gun. The big square body in the midnight blue tuxedo was quite motionless, and a sort of tense quietness exuded from it. It was a tiger watching the tethered donkey, and yet sensing danger. The face was ivory pale, but there was a likeness to the brother in London in the very straight, angry black brows and the short cliff of wiry hair cut en brosse, and in the ruthless jut of the jaw. The wheel whirred again, and the two pairs of eyes bent to watch it. It fell into one of the two green slots in the wheel, and Bond's heart lifted at the escape he had had. 00, said the stick man, raking in all the money on the table. Now for the last throw, thought Bond, and then out of here with $20,000 of the Spang money. He looked across at his employer. The two camera lenses and the cigar were still trained on him, but the pale face was expressionless. Fred. He handed a $5,000 plaque to the croupier and watched it slither down the table. Would the last coup be asking too much of the wheel? No, decided Bond with certitude. It would not. 5, Red, Leonard, said the croupier, obediently. I'll take the stake, said Bond. And thanks for the ride. Come again, said the stick man, unemotionally. Bond put his hand over the 4 fat plucks in his coat pocket and shouldered his way out of the crowd behind him and walked straight across the long room to the cashier's desk. 3 bills of 5,000 and 5 of 1s, he said to the man with the green eyeshade behind the bars. The man took Bond's 4 plucks and counted out the bills, and Bond put them in his pocket and walked over to the reception desk. Airmail envelope, please, he said. He moved to a writing desk beside the wall and sat down and put the 3 big bills in the envelope and wrote on the front, Personal, the Managing Director, Universal Export, Regent's Park, London, NW1, England. Then he bought stamps at the desk and slipped the envelope down the slot marked US Mail and hoped that there, in the most sacrosanct repository in America, it would be safe. Bond glanced at his watch. It said 5 minutes to midnight. He surveyed the big room for the last time, noted that a new dealer had taken over at Tiffany Case's table, and that there was no sign of Mr. Spang, and then he walked out through the glass door into the hot, stuffy night, and over the lawns to the turquoise building, and let himself into his room, and locked the door behind him. Chapter 18. Night Falls in the Passion Pit. How'd you make out? It was the next evening, and Ernie Cureo's cab was rolling slowly along the strip towards downtown Las Vegas. Bond had got tired of waiting for something to happen, and he had called up the Pinkerton man and suggested they get together for a talk. Not bad, said Bond. Took some money off them at roulette, but I don't suppose that'll worry our friend. They tell me he's got plenty to spare. Ernie Cureo snorted. I'll say, he said. That guy's so loaded with his stuff he don't need to wear spectacles when he's out driving. As the windshields of his Cadillacs ground to his eye doctor's prescription. Bond laughed. What's he spend it on besides that? He asked. He's daft, said the driver. He's crazy about the Old West. Bought himself a whole ghost town way out on Highway 95. He shored the place up. Wooden sidewalks, a fancy saloon, clapboard hotel where he rooms the boys, even the old railroad station. Way back in 05 or thereabouts, this dump, Specterville it's called, seeing how it's right alongside the Specter Range, was a rare and silver camp. For around 3 years, they dug millions out of those mountains, and a spur line took the stuff into Rhyolite, maybe 50 miles away. That's another famous ghost town. Tourist center now. Got a house made out of whiskey bottles. It used to be the railhead where the stuff got shipped to the coast. Well, Spang bought himself one of the old locos, one of the old Highland Lights, if you've ever heard of the engine, and one of the first Pullman state coaches. And he keeps them there in the station at Specterville, and weekends he takes his pals for a run into Rhyolite and back. Drives the train himself. Champagne and caviar, orchestra, girls, the works. Must be something. But I never seen it. You can't get near the place. Yes, sir. The driver let down the side window and spat emphatically into the road. That's how Mr. Spang spends his money. Daft, like I said. So that explained it, thought Bond. That was why he had heard nothing from Mr. Spang or his friends all through the day. Friday, and they would all be out at the boss's place playing trains, while he had swum and slept and hung about the Tiara all day waiting for something to happen. It was true that he had caught an occasional eye shifting away from his, and there had always been a servant of some sort, or one of the uniformed sheriffs hanging around in his neighbourhood, rather elaborately doing nothing in particular, but otherwise Bond might have been just any of the hotel guests. He had caught a single glimpse of the big man, and the circumstances had given him a perverse pleasure. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, after a swim and breakfast, Bond had decided to get a haircut at the barber's shop. There were still very few people about, and the only other customer in the shop was a large figure in a purple terry-cloth bath wrap, whose face, as the man lay tilted back in the chair, was hidden beneath hot towels. His right hand, dangling down over the arm of the chair, was being attended to by a pretty manicurist. She had a pink-and-white doll's face and a short mop of butter-coloured hair, and she squatted beside him in a low stool with a bowlful of instruments balanced on the tip of her knees. Bond, gazing into the mirror in front of his own chair, had watched with interest as the head barber delicately lifted up first one corner of the hot towels and then the other, and with infinite precaution snipped the hair out of the customer's ears with small thin scissors. Before he replaced the edge of the towel over the second ear, he bent down and said deferentially into it, "And the nostrils, sir?" There was an affirmative grunt from behind the towels, and the barber proceeded to open a window through the towels in the neighbourhood of the man's nose. Then he again went cautiously to work with the thin scissors. After this ceremony, there was dead silence in the small, white-tiled room, except for the soft clacking of the scissors round Bond's head, and the occasional ting as the manicurist dropped an instrument into her enamel bowl. And then there was a soft creaking as the head barber carefully wound the handle of the customer's chair so that it came upright. "How's that, sir?" said Bond's barber, holding a hand mirror behind his head. It was as Bond was inspecting the back of his head that it happened. Perhaps, with the changing elevation of the chair, the girl's hand slipped, but there was suddenly a muffled roar, and the man in the purple dressing gown sprang out of his chair, tore the towels off his face, and plunged a finger into his mouth. Then he took it out and bent quickly down and slapped the girl hard across the cheek so that she was knocked off her stool, and the enamel bowl of instruments went flying across the room. The man straightened himself and turned a furious face on the barber. "Fire that bitch!" he snarled. He put the hurt finger back in his mouth, and his slippers crunched amongst the scattered instruments as he strode blindly out of the door and disappeared. "Yes, sir, Mr. Spang," said the barber in a stunned voice. He started to bawl out the sobbing girl. Bond turned his head and said quietly, "Stop that." He got up from his chair and unwrapped the towel from round his neck. The barber gave him a surprised glance. Then he said quickly, "Yes, sir, mister," and bent to help the girl gather up her instruments. While Bond paid for his haircut, he heard the kneeling girl say plaintively, "It weren't my fault, Mr. Lucien. He was nervous today. His hands were trembling. Honest, they were. Ain't never seen him like that before. Tension, sort of." And Bond had a bad moment of pleasure at the thought of Mr. Spang's tension. Ernie Cureo's voice broke sharply in on his thoughts. "We got ourselves a tale, mister," he said out of the corner of his mouth. "Two of them, fore and aft. Don't look back. See that black Chevy sedan in front with the two guys? They got two driving mirrors, and they've been watching us and keeping step for quite a while. Back of us, there's a little red sex ship, old sports model Jag with a rumble seat. Two more guys with golf clubs in the back. But it just happens I know them guys. Detroit Purple Mob. Couple of lavender boys, you know, pansies. Golf ain't their game. The only irons they can handle are in their pockets. Just swivel your eyes round as if you was admiring the scenery. Watch their gun hands while I try 'em out. Ready?" Bond did as he was told. The driver put his foot on the accelerator and simultaneously turned off the ignition switch. The exhaust let go like an 88mm, and Bond saw the two right hands dive into the two brightly coloured sports jackets. Bond casually turned his head back. "You're right," he said. He paused. "Better let me out, Ernie. I don't want to get you into trouble." "Shucks," said the driver disgustedly. "They can't do nothing to me. You pay for any damage to the cab and I'll try and shake 'em, okay?" Bond took a $1,000 bill out of his note case and leant over and stuffed it into the pocket of the driver's shirt. "There's a grand to go on with," he said. "Thanks, Ernie. Let's see what you can do." Bond slipped his Beretta out of the holster and cradled it in his hand. This, he thought to himself, was just what he'd been waiting for.
Okay, fella, said the driver cheerfully. I've been looking for a chance to take a poke at the gang. I don't like being lent on, and they've been leaning on me and some of my friends for too long. Hold tight. Let's go.
It was a straight stretch of road with not much traffic about. The distant tops of the mountains were yellow in the setting sun, and the street was beginning to get blue with the 15 minutes of dusk when you can't make up your mind whether to switch on your lights. They were riding easily along at 40 with a low-slung Jaguar right on their tail and the black sedan a block ahead of them. Suddenly, so that Bond pitched forward, Ernie Curieu put his brakes full on and dry skidded to a stop with a scream of his tires. There was a shattering splinter of metal and glass as the Jaguar hit their fender. The cab lurched forward against its brakes, and then the driver jammed it into gear and, with a horrible tearing of iron, freed himself from the smashed radiator of the car behind and accelerated away down the road.
"That's screwed and proper," said Ernie Correa with satisfaction. "How'd they make an out?"
"Bust radiator grill," said Bond, watching out of the rear window. "Both front wings flattened, fender hanging off, windshield starred, maybe broken." He lost the car in the dusk and turned round. "They're out on the road trying to pull the front wings off the tires. They may be able to go before long, but it was a good start. Got any more like that?" "Not so easy now," grunted the driver. "War's been declared. Watch it. Better get down. The Chevy's pulled up at the side of the road. They may try shooting. Here we go." Bond felt the car surge forward. Ernie Correa was half lying along the front seat, driving with one hand and with his eyes watching the road ahead from just above the dash. There was a clang and two sharp cracks as they flashed past the Chevrolet. A handful of safety glass showered round Bond. Ernie Correa swore, and the car gave a swerve and then got back on its course. Bond knelt on the back seat and knocked out the glass of the rear window with the butt of his gun. The Chevrolet was coming after them, its eyes blazing.
"Hold it," said Correa with an odd, muffled voice. "Come into a sharp turn and stop under cover in the next block. Give you a clear shot as they come around after us."
Bond braced himself as the tires screamed and the car lurched on two wheels and then righted itself and stopped. Then he was out of the door and crouching with his gun up. The lights of the Chevrolet tore into the side road and there was a squeal of tortured rubber as it made the turn on the wrong side. "Now," thought Bond, before he can straighten up. Crack! A pause. Crack! 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 Four bullets at 20 yards, dead on the target. The Chevrolet didn't straighten up. It went over the curb on the other side of the road, hit a tree broadside, bounced off it and smashed into a lamp standard and turned completely round and slowly toppled over on its side. As Bond watched it, waiting for the echoes of the smashing metal to stop ringing in his ears, flame started to bleed slowly from the chromium mouth of the car. Someone was scrabbling at a window, trying to get out. At any moment, the flames would fill the vacuum pump and run the whole length of the chassis to the tank, and then it would be too late for the man inside. Bond had started across the road when there was a groan from the front seat of the cab, and he turned round to see Ernie Correa slip from under the wheel to the floor. Bond forgot the burning car as he tore open the door of the cab and leant over the driver. There was blood everywhere, and the whole of the driver's left arm was soaked in it. Bond somehow hauled him into a sitting position on the seat, and the driver's eyes opened.
"Oh, brother," he said through clenched teeth. "Get me out of here, mister, and drive like hell. Next thing that Jag will be after us. Then get me to a medic."
"Okay, honey," said Bond, slipping behind the wheel. "I'll take care of it." He rammed the car into gear and moved fast off down the road and away from the blazing pyre and the frightened people who had materialized out of the dusk and were standing watching the flames, their hands up to their mouths.
"Keep going,"
muttered Ernie Correa.
"This'll get you out near the Boulder Dam Road. See him in the mirror.
There's a low-slung car with a spotlight coming after us fast," said Bond. "Could be the Jag, about 2 blocks away now." He stamped on the accelerator and the cab hissed through the deserted side street.
"Keep going," said Ernie Correa. "We've got to hide up someplace and let him lose us. Tell you what, there's a passion pit just where this comes out on 95. Drive-in movie. Here we come, slow, sharp right. See those lights? Get in there, quick, right. Straight over the sand and between those cars. Off lights. Easy. Stop."
The cab came to a rest in the back row of half a dozen ranks of cars lined up to face the concrete screen that soared up into the sky and on which a huge man was just saying something to a huge girl. End of side 8.